Hi, I'm Mike Peterson, and you're listening to a podcast where nostalgia comes alive. It's Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show. Roll it!
Welcome to Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show, the podcast where nostalgia comes alive. Since July of 2021, Jake and his friends have interviewed professionals in the worlds of acting, directing, writing, puppeteering, and many more. Who will they be chatting with in this week's interview? Find out in this Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show, where nostalgia comes alive. Happy here with us. Thank you for joining. As always, I'm your host, Jake Duffenbaugh. And today, as always, our co-hosts, Chris Bixby and Matt Bingle. How you guys doing?
Doing good.
Doing good. Hi, everybody. How are you, Jake?
I'm doing great, Matt. Thank you for asking. What do we have for today?
Our guest today is a writer and producer. She wrote some episodes of the original Fraggle Rock, as well as Fraggle Rock Back to the Rock, writing the third episode, The Murgle Migration. She was also a writer for Sesame Street, along with some of its books. She was also head writer on The Magic School Bus and served as executive producer and executive in charge on various hit entertainment projects in the early 2000s, which we will get into. This and more, please welcome Jocelyn Stevenson. Welcome, Jocelyn. Happy to have you here.
Very nice to be here. Thanks, you guys.
Yes, absolutely. Happy to have you here.
Happy to have you here. So to kick this off, even though I kind of introduced you a little bit, could you tell our audience a bit about yourself and what you do?
What I do? Okay, I was anticipating this question. I should have thought of a good way to answer it that doesn't take 600 years because I'm so old that I have all this experience. The best way is actually, I went to Stanford University back in the dark ages. And in fact, I was there when Ted Bundy was there. Fun fact. Anyway, I did not know him. One day I was walking on the campus, and it was at the time when there was a lot of talk about free education and changing the education system and all this. And it was like, and I was contemplating all this, and I was like, it was almost like a voice came from somewhere saying, if you want to change the world, start with kids, start with kids. So that's been my organizing principle ever since. And I was taught in a daycare center after I finished at Stanford, and then I went to Sesame Street and I met Jim Henson. And so anyway, but I've always stayed in the kids area. I really particularly like things that have, you know, an educational spine, let's put it that way. But to quote, you know, something Jim used to say, it has to be goofiness in the service of truth. So
right.
There you go. Does that tell you enough?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
absolutely. Pretty much. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wake
so.
Yes.
So, what was your childhood like, and how did you grow up?
What was my childhood like? Okay, I grew up very nice, whatever family in the suburbs of Chicago, a suburb called Riverside, which is near the Brookfield Zoo, if anybody knows that part of the world. And yeah, you know, there was one year I pretty much went to school in that part of the world. You know, and then one year when I was 8 years old, we went out to Wellesley, Massachusetts for a year. Well, my dad was a cardiologist, he was a doctor, but he was studying then to be a cardiologist. So he was a professional. My mom was a mom, though she'd been a nurse. I had three younger brothers. One of them was killed in a car accident when he was 15.
Oh.
And, idyllic childhood, I guess it was it. But it was at that time when, you know, we were fighting for all the rights that are systematically being removed now from women and all that. So it was a quite interesting time to be living, as is now, to be honest. I didn't move to 25 different countries as, you know, following a military father around or anything like that. I grew up in the suburb of Chicago, which I have to say, when it came to going to university, I couldn't wait to, I mean, one of the reasons I went to Stanford was because it was so far away. So, there was that, but not because I hated my parents, but because, you know, you guys are young. You know what that's like. You don't want to be around. You want to get out.
Right, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially with suburbia, which can be limiting.
Right.
But I had a good education. You know, I often talk about it. We had a good, I went to the, you know, public school, and but it was right around after the Russians had sent Sputnik up. And so our science education was off the charts because they just wanted to educate my sort of generation to try to, you know, make it possible for America to compete. So I had a great science education. I loved it. And then maybe that's what teed me up for the magic school bus later on.
So what kind of sparked your interest in becoming a writer and producer? Like what kind of got you into wanting to have a career in that?
Well, I kind of, all the things that happened to me, I felt were luck. And it was the first time I thought about writing was when we were doing Fraggle Rock. We were thinking about, and I've been working with the Henson Company, but in the publishing department. And I've been sort of working on publishing the annuals and the Muppet books that went along with, I don't know, with movies and things or whatever they were doing. No, it was before the movies. And Jim pulled together, but I was always really interested. As I said to you, I was, the kid thing was really my focus. And Jim's, you know, they were doing the Muppet Show and they were grown-up TV, right? And sometimes didn't like being considered a kid's show at all. You know, they were doing puppetry for adults. And, but he started, we started, I know it was because he had, the Muppet Show was so vastly popular. And because there was a person called Peter Orton who worked at, he actually headed up Hit Entertainment ultimately, but he worked at Sesame Street and worked on trying to get Sesame Street distributed internationally and found out how hard it was to do that, right? And he said to Jim, you have the opportunity to do an international kids show where you could, because you have such a great reach internationally, where you could make some of it, you know, the bulk of it be a Muppet thing. So all that could be dubbed, but there would be a beginning, a middle, and end, or, you know, book, what do you call book marks. No, it isn't. It's book. What's the word I want? Anyway, to that could be done locally. So a country would have this program with their local, you know, in their studio and their people and all that, but it would have all of the Muppet stuff, the Fraggle stuff, basically, and so it would look like it was something they could never afford to do on their own, but it looked great for a local show. So that was the idea behind it. And so Jim loved that idea. And then he started to say, he started like, wow, an international children's show. And then came, I will get to the answer to your question in a minute, but at the international children's show, he said, then came, that's what he called it, the international children's show. And then he said, okay, kids all over the world, I think I want you guys to create something that will help stop war. Okay. And he pulled together a group of us that were working on it at that time. At that time, I didn't know what I was going to do in relation to the whole thing. As I said, I'd been doing Muppet books and all that. But when it came to figuring out what people would do, I asked Jerry Jewell, who had been the head writer of
Muppet Show,
one of my great creative mentors. I love him, still miss him greatly. I asked him if you know, he would mind mentoring me, really, because I didn't know anything about writing for television. And he said, you know how to write character, that's all you need. And so he said, yeah. So I went to Jim. So that was when I thought, wow, that's interesting. I could try to do this. And I went to Jim and I said, do you mind if Jerry said it's okay, do you mind if that, you know, if I try to be a writer on the show? And Jim, the enlightened boss that he was, said, I don't care what you do, you know, as long as you do it. As long as you, and if it doesn't work for you to be a writer on the show, you can go back to doing the publishing. So win-win. But that's also because he was quite an enlightened kind of boss. It was great. So that's when I started and I learned. I remember calling Jerry up and looking, you know, studying his scripts and things and calling him up going, what's a two shot? And I didn't, you know, I just thought all this terminology was so technical. And he said, it is a shot with two characters in it. it's not. Oops, I did my balloons. And it's not that difficult. And so I had to learn the language, and then Jerry, we were all developing three-act structure. We're doing the shows as three-act structure. That was where I learned. That was when I started. I mean, I'd written little things for Sesame Street magazine, but this was really big. This was what started me on the writing career, I guess you'd say. Sorry,
Nice.
I feel like I'm making terribly long answers.
No, it's okay.
Oh, it's fine.
You can you edit it all, right? You edit it all down to something not too boring.
So, your work with the Jim Henson Company began writing a number of Muppet-based children's books. How did that come about?
It with about Muppet-based children's books? You
Yeah.
mean
Yeah,
like
like how did writing, 'cause I know you said your career kind of started with them writing books before writing for
Yes.
different series. How did that kind of come about?
Well, I'd been writing books for Sesame Street. And then when I was working on Sesame Street, and then I was getting married to somebody who lived in the UK. Again, this is where I'm saying luck, luck, luck. All these things line up, right? And I said to Jim, well, I'm going to have to, because I'd met Jim lucky out of luck. But anyway, it was a smaller operation then, and everybody worked together. And I said to him, I'm going to have to leave Sesame Street because I'm moving to the UK. And he said to London, no, UK. And he said, well, we're going to be in there doing the Muppet Show. Why don't you come and work with us? So I was like, okay. Oh no, I couldn't believe it. I said, well, I don't know if I'm going to live in London. And again, it was another one of those, so meaning you're going to be in London. I'm not going to live in London necessarily. He said, I don't care where you live as long as you get the job done. Again, his attitude. So yeah, that's, and then what you do is you work so hard in order not to make it anybody else's problem that you don't live, you're not there in the office every day. So I was doing Muppet books. I had done Sesame Street books. That's how it came about, sort of went one to the other.
Very nice. So you co-created and wrote for the original Fraggle Rock series. What was your part in creating the show?
Well, there were five of us, and so we were all quite equally weighted, but I was the only girl. This was Jim, Jerry, Michael Frith, Duncan Kenworthy, and me, and I was the only girl. So I will take some credit along with Karen Prell, because I worked with her once she was cast for Red and that kind of character. And but no, we all worked. We were all in the service of the best idea. That was what we always said about Fraggle Rock. It was whatever. And we were working when Jim was doing the Dark Crystal with Frank. And so Jim would join our. We were working in his house in London, in Hampstead, and he'd come back from a day. Just the Dark Crystal, as you know, it's beautiful, but it's heavy duty compared to Fraggle Rock,
Oh,
And
yes.
we'd say, oh, Jim, we've just decided that the biggest thing in a Fraggle's life is figuring out what to have for lunch. At which point he would just collapse on the floor laughing because he needed to laugh. And then there, yes, it was. Did I answer your question? Because I could keep going
Yeah.
on
Yeah,
Fraggle.
sure.
And well,
Yeah.
but can I, it's
Yeah.
another thing, another really cool story, which is
Sure,
somehow
yeah.
it's been written up. Was naming the Doozers.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Love the
That
Doozers.
was Jim and I. We were walking in Hampstead Heath, and Don Saline was one of the Muppet workshop people. I mean, much beloved original. He was the person Jim always called the essence checker, because he could look at a puppet and just go like this with an eye and turn the puppet from being a puppet into a Muppet. And and he died tragically, and there was a bench in Hampstead Heath that was dedicated to him. And Jim said, should we go find Don's bench? And we'd been naming all the characters, and he'd named Moki, and we thought Wembley was because we were in London, and I can't remember who named Boober. I think Jim named Boober too, and I had read, and you know, so we were. This is where we were in naming it mode. I don't even think we'd picked Fraggle Rock by that point, but we were trying to figure out what do we call. I think we decided the Gorgs were the Gorgs. What do we call these little guys? And so we were walking along. We found Don's bed, and this is the kind of thing that those creature characters with the way they worked and all that was the kind of thing Don would have loved. And this is a true story. Jim and I walking like sat down at the same time on the bench, at the same time said, "Doozers."
Really? Wow!
Oh my God!
Oh, that's crazy!
Wow!
And we both went, "Oh, thank you, Don." It felt. So yeah, that was another story that story gives me the shivers on the top of my head. I love it.
Wow.
So yeah, there were many. I mean, working on that show, I mean, God, it was just the most amazing thing ever.
Oh yeah.
In my career, obviously, and so yeah, and working with those people and just a production that, like I said, It didn't matter if an idea came from a props assistant. If it was a great idea, we were all in the service of the best idea. And there was this feeling of discovery rather than creation. We weren't creating the show, we were discovering it. And it's a subtle but very important difference. And and then yours truly was honing her skills as a script writer. But a lot of the people we worked with weren't script writers. I mean, Jerry did not want, I was the only person who had a background in kids. He wanted poets and playwrights and different people to come in and write the show so that it wasn't a kids show. Very interesting.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so since we're talking about Fraggle Rock, this may be a tough question to answer because there were so many, but are there any episodes of the show you wrote that kind of stick out as some of your favorites?
Yes, it was the one about Red finding her song, the minstrels.
Yes,
and that was quite early on for me because I think it was show 18 or something. See, I remember that much, but it was the first time I really got it. I also just had an idea I really wanted to get out there, and I created the character of Cantus that Jim did.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So that was like huge. So I think of that show with huge fondness because it really felt like a show I had the least amount of problems with in terms of writing because I don't know, I just believed in it so much. And it was, and then, as I said, it was Jim's character and that sort of Zen, there are no rules and those are the rules, that kind of, and he was so brilliant at delivering that and being that character. So also then I'm working with, you know, Stevie Whitmire and Davey Goals. I mean, this was
I love Steve.
Yeah.
He's wonderful.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
Yeah.
Have you ever had a chance to talk to him or not?
Yes. Yes, we did.
Oh, yeah. We did.
When did you do that?
In December.
Early December.
Yeah. December 1st, yeah.
Yep.
Oh, cool. Last month. To that show. Yeah. No, I love Steve.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
He's just the best.
And one of the best, world's best puppeteers.
Yes.
Yes. So what was it like writing The Bells of Fraggle Rock? Or co-writing, I should say.
Yeah, we co-wrote that. You know, that's a hard question to answer. It was fun, and it was, you know, and I'm working with the Jewel, so it was kind of, you know, you work with your Jerry, my mentor. He was always much funnier. I could leave all the jokes to him. and, you know, and it was all, we are working with people who are coming from the same context. You know, we believe the same things about the show. And do you like that show?
Oh, yes. I love The Bells of Fraggle Rock. We actually,
I love that. Love that special.
We actually were watching it during the holidays with some of our other friends, and I just love that special.
I have to watch it. I haven't watched it for years. Sorry. I haven't watched it for years. But I loved it, too. No, it was beautiful.
Yes.
So what was it like? It was, you know, it was kind of easier than doing it on your own. You know, and satisfying. Again, it's the part of, that you have the whole Muppet machine behind you, all those builders, all the puppeteers. I mean, just, you know that what you're going to do, what you want to do is going to look amazing. It's, I can't begin to tell you what that feels like, having that. And, you know, it was the same thing working on the new Fraggle Rock. Wow, you know, just, oh my God, what they were managed to do with that. It's incredible.
That's great.
So my jumping ahead for you, sorry.
That's okay.
No, it's
no worries. No worries, it okay. happens. So, now, who are some of your favorite characters to write for?
On which program?
On a Fraggle.
On Fraggle. I loved writing for Red. Really part of that too was because it was such a collaboration with Karen. It was so much fun. And the other character I really liked was Sidebottom. Do you know who that is?
Oh yeah, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
That's the downside of Boober that, no, that's the joyful side of Boober that he keeps on the side, Sidebottom. And that was because I worked closely with Davey on that character too. So, you know, turning Boober into a kind of, not schizophrenic is the wrong word, but exploring that other side of Boober that he could only access in dreams. And Sidebottom came because living here in Britain, there's a company or a family, it's a name, Sidebottom. And I said this to somebody here, a Brit that I know, I said, Sidebottom, that's a funny name. They said, no, it's not Side, it's City Bottom.
Oh, that's great.
So yeah, that made me laugh.
That's great.
For Fraggle Rock, it was Sidebottom. I loved writing that. I mean, Goba was always, he was always the straight guy. And I mean, Wembley was always fun. They were all fun to write. And then Carter Penduzer, she was another.
Oh, yeah.
And I worked on her character a lot with Kathy. Kathy Mullen did her. And that was another, just suddenly remembering the flooping episode where all the jumped.
It's a classic.
It took us till 4 o'clock in the morning to shoot that thing. People were very, very angry at me because it was so hard to do. But it's like I say, you have the whole gang behind you. So people stayed and they shot it, and it's a funny little episode.
Right.
And then also working with Phil Balsam and God bless him, and Dennis Lee. You know, you knew you had two songs an episode. They wrote two songs every episode, and there were almost none that we rejected. And our sort of rule for all the songs was that they had to move the show along. You couldn't stop and sing a song and then carry on with the story. So that was good. That was quite a good way to work.
Nice
natural flow. So you were also a head writer for Fraggle. Can you kind of talk about your responsibilities as head writer?
Well, that was when Jerry, who'd been doing it forever, he decided he wanted to spend more time at home because he'd been doing the Muppet Show before Fraggle Rock, and he and Susan hadn't been home very much for years. And so we decided to split it. And as head writer, I had always consulted with him. I was always part of the head. In a way, we almost had a head writing team because we had with Larry Merkin and Jerry and me. And even when Jerry was at home, it was just that I was the one who had to deliver the notes and all that kind of thing. And that's when I learned, again, from Jerry, the it's a skill giving good notes because you have the notes you have to give have to inspire people to want to do better, you know, particularly if you have criticisms. But Jerry would say, of course you knew, but Jerry would say to you, I love the typeface you used. Of course you thought, you knew then you were in deep trouble if that was the best thing. But he always started out with a compliment. And so that was a great thing to learn as a head writer who's, you know, giving notes. There were times too though when he would say, oh my God, that joke in the middle of the third act is so hilarious. I go, yeah, Jerry, it was yours. You gave me that joke. it was the creative generosity too. That was another big takeaway from all this experience.
So. Oh, that's wonderful. It's wonderful. So, as Matt mentioned in your introduction, you also got to briefly write for the reboot, Fraggle Rock Back to the Rock, and you also worked as consulting producer on that show. Can you kind of talk about your involvement with that and kind of getting to come back?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, it was an amazing experience. Originally, they told me about it. The Henson Company, Lisa Henson had told me about it, that it was coming up and before the pandemic. So there was the idea that, you know, you'd come and spend some time, everybody would be in the same room. Well, that went away, didn't it? And because they kept going. And I loved Matt Fussfeld and Alex Cuthbertson. I love them, who took over the head. They were the showrunners, completely different skills to mine. And what I really appreciated was when we put together the writer's room, that they, because I just considered myself in department old fart. You know, there were a lot of us who'd been working on the original show that weren't going to be working on the new one. I mean, a lot of people did, but Alex and Matt asked me to come for the first series. They asked me to come for the first three weeks of the writer's room and to write a script. Okay, so the writer's room was in LA. I'm in the UK. It's an 8-hour time difference. The writer's room would start at 6 o'clock at night, my time. Not good for me. It's not. And we got, so I would be in the writer's room from 6 until 9, and it was fine. And I'd never worked in a proper American writer's room before. We didn't do it like this. I haven't, any of the programs I've worked here on the UK, we haven't done it. It's not how we structure it. I loved it, really interesting. But then for the second season, so we did that, but I was only involved in whatever happened in the first 3 weeks. For the second season, they asked me again to write a script, which was, I was chuffed, or I was very pleased about that. I love that British expression, chuffed. I think that's good. And I was really pleased about that. But they asked me to be in the room for 20 weeks for the whole time. So the interesting thing about that, well, it was exhausting, but the interesting thing about it was I got to work on every script. And so you remember how I said to you that Don Celine, Jim used to call him the essence checker?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I told them this story, and they decided I was the essence checker for the final. Uh-huh. And I really appreciated that, because a lot of those, because Alex and Matt are comedy writers, you know, and you know, we would be pitching, and I loved this process because it was hilarious. You're just in tears, you're laughing so hard, but you're so funny, and you're pitching on what joke Moki might be able to say in this particular scene. But then I'd have to go, you guys, this is Wembley's story. We haven't seen him for two scenes. Why are we pitching on a Moki joke? Let's figure, you know. So then they go, you're right. So it was my input with a lot of that was structural, and which is how the first season, the first show was done. And so, yeah, that was, and it keeps it, you know, somebody's story, it keeps it honest. And so I was able to contribute to every script. But the really interesting thing was also being able to contribute to where the show goes. Wait till you guys see. It goes someplace where with ideas that we in the original group would never have dreamed of. We couldn't have even imagined them, but it's all Fraggle Rock. And so it gave me a huge appreciation for the flexibility of this thing that we'd created, discovered, you know. And this team just went for it. I'm really interested to hear what people think about this new season.
And also John Tartaglia does amazing work with that too.
Yes,
love John so
taking
much.
On Gobo executive oh. producing it.
Now it's creative
directing. Yes, creative supervisor. Yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing happened because he's a force of nature.
Gosh.
And yes. He gets the characters. And you know, I consider him a dear friend.
Such
he's
a great guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really is.
On the subject of inheriting, you know, Donna Kimball has done a wonderful job taking on Moki.
Love Donna.
Yes.
She's the best.
Yes. She's amazing.
Oh, good. Moki, I love Kathy. I love her to bits. But Moki's funnier now.
Yeah, I can see
Without
that.
being,
Yeah,
without
I
getting
see it.
away from her character.
Yeah.
Which is just, you know, it's no, Dawn has done a brilliant job. I had so much fun writing her. I think both my scripts. Yeah, the second season, the second one I wrote was what I read. I'm a writer. I can't even talk. My set was also a Moki script, so it was really fun. But unfortunately, because it's, you know, we could not in the old days, a writer would be on the set the whole time for your scripts. Oh my God, it would make such a difference because you could see what problems anybody was having with blocking. You can and you were there to, you know, to I remember one time it was a show that Jim I'd written and Jim was directing. Don't remember which one. It was early. It must have been early on in season in the first very first series, and I was standing next to him and he said to me, "This isn't working, is it?" I said, "No, it's not." And he said, "Well, can you make it work?" And I went, "Yeah, I'm sure I can." And I stood there and he went, "Now?" That was when I learned about rewriting on the go. I just had thought, oh, I'll be able to go back to my office, sit in my whatever, and figure it out. No, now. So, you know, you had to rewrite on the spot. Oh God, that's such good training, I have to tell you. But we didn't weren't able to do any of that with this with the new Fraggle Rock, which was too bad. Because
Yeah.
I feel like the writers really missed out on seeing Charlie Feldman. They were able to go to their show when that was taping, but nobody else, I think, was able to really, except for Matt and Alex, obviously. They were there the whole time. But that's where the because you watch the puppeteers. I used to watch. Oh, Scared Silly is another show I loved of my first bunch years ago, where it's Boober and Wembley scaring each other and if so, that was where we introduced the idea of the Bolubius and all this, but I'd gotten the idea from watching Steve and Davey scare each other on the set, you know. From so, that's the advantage when you're on the set all the time watching the puppeteers just in their downtime, because they're hilarious.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Anything
So
else with that?
moving, I was gonna say moving on from Fraggle Rock, you also got to write this Henson special, The Tales of the Bunny Picnic, which was a very fun special.
I really love. Now that I've got a story about that special too.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so it was an idea that Cheryl and Jim had about these bunnies on, you know, in Hampstead Heath and what would and the dog, and you know, they gave me the sort of bits of it, and I was working with Duncan Kenworthy because he was pr I think he was producing it. Yeah, he was producing it. And I was about to have my third kid, so I was pregnant, and I was actually, when I was in labor, still working on the script. And I remember, I handed this thing in, having worked, you know, and Duncan, and it's not like I've been doing it completely solo because Duncan had been contributing. And Jim called me, and he said, "I don't like it, but I don't know why." Now, these are not good words to hear. So I just started on deep breath, started on page one. I said, "Do you like this?" Yeah, that's okay. "Do you like that?" You know, and we went through and I was able to determine what he didn't like. And the script is a gabillion trillion times better for all the rewriting. I really like that script now. And I mean, I like the show. The show's beautiful. And yeah, but that was that. There was that moment. Are any of you writers? Writers? Are all of you writers?
No,
No.
not really.
No,
No.
it's like, you know, somebody looks at your work, this, for instance, and says to you, "You know what? I don't like it, but I don't know why." It's not, it's a hard comment to take. Anyway, so that, but the Bunny Picnic was really, and we shot that here in London.
Nice.
Yes. And yeah, it was really, again, it's beautiful, you know. And when you look at it in the beginning, I watch it every now and then, because I showed it recently to one of my grandchildren, and you know the butterflies and all that, and they're all puppets. There's no CG in there. It's so nice.
So, kind of going back to other projects you created. What was working on the Ghost of Fafnir Hall like?
Oh, that was really fun too. That came out because a music producer called Milt Oaken told Jim that he was really concerned about the state of music education in the United States, and would be there be anything Jim could, you know, the Muppets could do to help. And I don't think we did in the end. We should have, though. You know, it's like these things where you make this thing and then, oh, never mind. It's frustrating when it doesn't get picked up, and you know, you have momentum, but then for whatever reasons. But yeah, we the Ghost of Fafnir Hall. Jim put me in, and I met Milt, which was really interesting and fun, and because he was the person, he was the music director for Peter Paul and Mary. And I mean, you probably guys don't even know who they are, right? Peter, Paul, and Mary. They were a folk group way, way back, Bob Dylan days, right? I loved them. And they sang really beautiful harmonies. And I would stick my head underneath our stereo to, because we didn't have headphones, to listen to the harmonies. And I said to Milt during this meeting, I said, you know, I love people. I love the harmonies. I learned everything I know about harmony from listening to those harmonies. And he said, I wrote all those harmonies. So that was a moment when you actually say to the guy who wrote, anyway. So Jim just gave me that project to figure out how, and I brought together a bunch of music educators. There was a Canadian composer, music educator called Murray Schafer, whose work I really liked, R. Murray Schafer. He'd written a book called Soundscapes. He was sort of the person who first said that word and that concept of you know, just taking a microphone out on the street and hearing what the soundscape is. But his whole attitude was everyone can make music. And I saw these tapes of him going into classes of 10-year-olds and saying, by the time we finish this class, you're all going to be composers. And they were like, yeah, pull the other one. Because their idea of a composer was something, you know, Beethoven or Mozart or something like that. And then he'd start and say, okay, pick sounds, and he'd get them all to pick sounds and then put the sounds together. By the end, they'd composed a piece. And he said, you know, see, and I thought this was brilliant and very Muppety. And so that was what the Ghost of Fafnir Hall was based on. And then we started to get these, you know, musicians. The first one was Joni Mitchell, and who said she'd do it. Again, do you even know who Joni Mitchell is, you guys? And she said she'd do it, yeah. And and once somebody big like that, she was big, and once somebody big like that says they'll do it, you're on your way. Because it was unlike anything else I'd done. The whole idea was that there's this place called Fafnir Hall, which is like Carnegie Hall, and you can open a door and there can be you can see a bunch of boulders singing rock music, get it? Or you open the door and there's, I mean, think if there was anybody that you guys would know, there, Dizzy Gillespie, or, you know, there were, you know, some major musician. And yeah, it was interesting and fun. Mm-hmm. And we did one series, we did it with Tyne Tees here in Britain. And then we had people that were asking to work with us on the next series, but they, you know, I can't remember why, just didn't get picked up. These things happen.
Right. So,
but you can see bits of it on YouTube.
Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome. So now for a couple of years, you were a writer on Sesame Street. What was that kind of like getting to write on that?
Sesame Street, yes. Yeah. So I wrote on that. Yeah. Well, not long, because it was hard, because I was doing it at a distance. And so, and I wasn't working there anymore. They asked me to be a writer after I'd left, you know. And it was hard to do it at a distance, because you're just not in the middle of it all. And a lot of what went on about their decisions about who was going to do what and which bits would be part of which shows and all that happened in a room that you weren't in. So, I wrote enough of a show. I wrote long enough to get an Emmy Award for it with 12 other people. It wasn't for me, but you get the award. So that's
right. Yeah.
Right.
I'm sort of can sit it in your window. Anyway, as if I don't care about that. But so yeah, I don't have much to say about writing for Sesame Street. It was more when I was there and was working on the Sesame Street magazine, and I mean that was a bigger deal for me because that was the very beginning of my career, really. And
Right.
I started as a secretary, so that's and blessing my mother for making me suggesting strongly that I learn how to type. So. You guys all you learn how to type with computers in school anyway, but we
Oh
had to
yeah.
sit, we had to do special learning in those days on a typewriter.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Just like
All
your
right.
Some other Henson series you created and wrote for are The Animal Show and Mop the Top Shop. I guess starting with The Animal Show, since that came first, can you talk about the creation process of that?
The Animal Show with Stinky and Jake.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a collaboration with, can't remember, I should, this is terrible, a wildlife, oh, damn, I can't remember which ch channel it was because it's not no longer, it was an ITV channel, who had a strong wildlife department. And thinking, and then there was this idea of a talk show with animals where the animals would be selling their species. And so this amused us all. And that was where we started, was it so that, Stinky and Jake were the talk show hosts, and then animals would come on and they'd talk about how great their species were. And then we'd have all this live action footage that we were able to cut and use and everything. So yeah, that was fun. Oh, it was really good for particularly. Have you talked to Bill Beretta, for instance,
Oh
yet?
yes, Bill
Oh,
Burr is a
Bill,
great
yes,
friend.
he's
Yes,
wonderful.
wonderful.
He's just the best.
He's a great
Yeah,
friend.
he is, and
Love Bill so
he
much.
started there. I mean, he because he had was really just a rookie puppeteer at that point, but he'd had to he'd just throw puppets onto him, and he'd have to go off and just do this whole character. And so he again learning on the job, and he was so much fun to work with. So that was fun. So yeah, and
That's
that
wonderful. What
was
about the
also
other?
Steve and Dave, Stinky and Jake, where Steven and where Dave, Stevie was Jake, the big polar bear, and Dave was
Nice.
Skunk. And
Nice.
so they're good value.
Nice. And
And the
so with
so and the
Mop a Top Shop, how did that come about?
Top Shop came about because there was it was I mean there was obviously a I think there was a broadcast reason for wanting to do it, and we were going to do I think they're 10 minutes or 7 minutes, they're short, and for young kids. But there was this shop in we used to go to the west coast of Scotland to a place called a Harlacle a Harlacle, and there was a shop there which when my kids were little they thought it had everything. You could buy a book, you could buy a sponge, you could buy, a drill bit or whatever. You could buy anything in this shop. So that was the idea. Well, if Mop a Top Shop was there, you want it, we got it, everything, So they so and so people would come in, and people customers. So again, it was different puppets all the time. So puppeteers having a chance to do a zillion different characters and not wanting something that went along with some problem that they had. I don't know. But it came from the original idea, just came from this idea of this shop that had anything you wanted, so it could be, yeah, abstract.
Nice.
And there were, yeah, and there were, there were, there were the, there was the mouse family that Moosey Mouse and his mom and dad who lived. I mean, so we had these cutaways to their antic, it was silly. It was silly and Muppety. And again, really fun. We did it in Britain, really fun to make. So I didn't have to decamp anywhere far away.
Wonderful.
I don't know what happened to that. I mean, we did quite a lot of episodes, and then yeah, I mean, things get replaced. Again, I assume you can see it on
Yeah.
YouTube.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I
it's on
think
the Jim Henson Company channel.
Yeah.
They've got so much TV.
They
Oh yeah.
do.
Yes, on that channel. Yes, indeed. Yes.
Yes.
So now, What was a lot? I'm kind of curious. What was it like getting to working on the Hoobs?
Oh, the Hoobs. It's nutsy. Yeah, the Hoobs. Yeah, that was, again, it was really the, I only was involved really in helping it set it up conceptually. And I remember one of the ideas that I had that I think we ended up using was that a question always leads to another question. It's all about asking questions and questions. But the actual doing of that was, at that point, the idea, after I had just come, I think I'd just come off of, I had Mop-A-Top Shop of producing, writing, head writing a billion episodes. The idea of going into another one, and so I was involved as a consultant, and then my great friend Melly Buse took it over, and yeah, so that's, but it was nuts, you know, again. But they, I wasn't there on the, you know, I wasn't in the trenches so much on that one. Didn't it, what, do you have the year of when that was?
Think it was like probably early
Of
2000s,
the Hooves?
like
Yeah, I think it was 2000, maybe
2001.
2001, I
Right.
think.
Yeah. Okay. And then, because soon thereafter,
Yeah, it's also one. Yeah.
okay, soon thereafter, I would have gone to work at HIT.
Oh, okay.
That's
Right.
right.
Yeah. And that was when I decided to sit on the other side of the desk for a while. Yeah, that was then. That was, yeah, it was off. I was offered, again, this person, Peter Wharton, I was offered, whom I'd known for years, but was his head of creative was leaving, and he asked me if I wanted that job. And it was like, yeah, you know what? I'd worked with the company. We'd done a thing called Fairies, and I'd worked with them on Brambley Hedge. I'd worked with the company. But this was the opportunity to see what it was like to be an executive. It took
Right.
me about 3 years to realize I hated it with a passion, but that's okay. It was a really good experience. But during that time, we took on board Barney and Thomas and Friends, and we got Bob the Builder. We kept, you know, going with Bob the Builder. We had Angelina Bellamy's amazing properties I got to work with, and there's
Oh
another
yeah.
show. Yeah, we had this thing called Rub-A-Dubbers,
Oh,
which
Rubber Dubbers,
yes.
yes, that's a wonderful show.
Rub-A-Dubbers, yes, love that
Ew,
show.
I love that show. Yeah, that was, here come the Rub-A-Dubbers, splish splash.
Splash, splash, splash,
yeah.
here come the
Yes,
Rub-A-Dubbers, splish
yes.
splash splash,
You
yeah.
guys,
I love these
yes.
Yeah, there's some
Yeah.
good ones.
So we're, but working, it was an interesting experience. And I think honed my understanding of it, what Jim used to say, you know, if you do good work, the money will come. And people go, yeah, whatever. But I think that's really true. And if you're focusing on making money, you know, oh, let's, we need to do a show where are the five characters, we can do a toy line in, rather than an idea or what you think kids need. I just, that was that experience. You need to be looking at what kids need. You need to be thinking about filling gaps. You need to be, you know, and then the money will come. And you do it well, and you have good writing, and the money will come.
Right.
So yeah, it was, because I would have, you know, I would have arguments with the money guys just because they didn't think I was paying enough attention.
The
other series you got to wrote for that company, Thomas,
Yeah.
P P
Thomas.
Pingu.
Pingu, yeah.
Pingu, yeah.
Yes,
Oh, and
and
the other series you haven't met, which it wasn't hit, but before, was Charlie Chalk. Did that come across your radar at all? Charlie Chalk was
No, I don't think it did,
no.
no.
That was Woodland Productions, the same people who'd done Postman, the original Postman Pat.
Oh,
And
nice.
so that, but the reason I bring that up was that was working with stop motion animation, which then prepared me when I later went on to work with HOT too. Yeah, Charlie Chalk, check it out if you, it's a cute little show.
All right. Nice.
Definitely will.
Awesome. And
Yeah, just add something to your nostalgia bag there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. And far enough, what I'm going to mention before moving on, you actually wrote specifically one episode for Barney and Friends.
That, did I? Yeah.
That episode particularly, I remember watching so much for VHS. So that, if you remember, I Red, Yellow, and Blue.
No, I don't remember. Was it a good one?
Yeah, it was basically an episode where like Barney and the kids would talk about like different colors and
different
things like
colors.
That.
I don't remember again.
Yeah, it's about like where it was the kids. It was only Barney and Baby Bob were only there, and there was like caboose inside. There was like, a collection of colors, like one yellow collection, other one's a red collection, other one's a blue collection. But yeah, I mean, where I remember watching episode, I mean, it's been a bit, so I lost some watching, but I think you did it. You actually did a good job running that episode, actually.
Yeah.
Because I'll tell you what, when I got to working with the people, the Barney people, it was great because.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, such wonderful people.
Because a lot of them have been there for a long time, like Fred and
Fred.
Here was a family like the Henson family. And these people, and you know, but when I met them all, they were thinking, like, who the hell are you? Because we bought them, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Who the hell are you? Right. That was, we had to kind of get through all that, but we all ended up loving each other. But mostly because a guy called Steve White wrote a lot of the episodes.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yes, such a wonderful
writer.
And exactly.
The Barney franchise.
And I really,
such an amazing job.
It's really hard to do what he did. I have such admiration to write for 2-year-olds. It's insanely difficult. Mm-hmm. And so I had such enormous respect for what he did. I liked him a lot. It was fun working.
Yeah.
And again, it's that, you know, it was a group of people really hugely dedicated to what they were doing, believed in it. Oh, and I met Cheryl Leach before I did the whole thing.
Oh, wow.
Oh, nice.
I was sent when I was Cheryl. Told, I was told, love I got the so job much. At HIT my first day. Peter says, oh, welcome to HIT. Glad to see you're going to Connecticut tomorrow. Why? Well, we're acquiring Barney, and I want you to meet Cheryl Leach. She was the creator. And so off I went. And she and I got on like a house on fire. I've been in touch with her not that long ago. We're still in touch. And
that's lovely.
And to and also just to understand what she, you know, what her thinking behind the whole show. Essence checking again, right?
Yeah.
It was to try to keep that part of it. And so that was really great.
Definitely.
Thomas was different. Yes. Thomas
yeah,
we had to make they were filming it. They would film Thomas on film. We had to, you know, I was told we had to make it cheaper. Because they were spending a lot of money. So that was a bit more of an uphill battle. But also, again, God, you know, you have, as somebody said to me, it's you're writing for tables on wheels because they can't do anything. No. But it was pretty, that was also fun. Also a group of people who cared a lot about what they do.
Absolutely. So moving back in time a little bit, you were also writer and head writer for another PBS show, The Magic School Bus. An absolutely wonderful show.
Love
what was
that
like
show.
Working on The Magic School Bus?
Now, The Magic School Bus was really hard because, again, that was based in New York, so I had the time difference thing. I've just spent a lot of time going back and forth. But The Magic School Bus, we decided, the great writing team, and we decided that we wanted 3-act structure, but what drove the stories was the science. It wasn't like, oh, we have a story and we stop and do the science, which a lot of science shows do, right? We wanted the science to be so much a part of the story that you hardly noticed that you were learning it. So when a character, you know, you have your 3-act structure, meaning you have your character has a problem, there's a goal, there's a risk, and what do they learn? So all of those things, what they learned would actually be the science. And it was really challenging. And we actually designed a whole way of writing for The Magic School Bus, which then the producer, Kristen Laskus-Martin, went on to do, Cyber Attack, whatever those, was that... A show about maths?
Cyber Chase?
Cyber Chase.
Thank you. Cyber
oh, Chase. Love that show. Yes.
I didn't work on Cyber Chase, but they used the same, but Kristen had produced Magic School Bus too, and she used the same approach to writing scripts for that, for Cyber Chase, that she
oh, did wow.
Magic School Bus. So, awesome. Yeah. And it that was, I mean, it was really fun. It's really fun. It was really fun to work with scientists. Oh, the but the reboot that we did for
Netflix. Yeah, Magic School Bus Rides Again. Yeah.
Rides
yeah.
Again.
Then I got to tell you guys this because it was then. Okay. So then I was, again, I was brought back, the aged one brought back. that's not true. I wasn't the only one from the original team on the writing team. And we would, but the, then we had, in the old days, we had one guy, Michael Templeton, remember his name, who was our science advisor and was hooked up with the NSF and all this kind of, because we were getting funded by the NSF when we were the original series. But now you there's a thing called the Science and Entertainment Exchange, which is part of the National Science Foundation. I think it might be part of it. And there's a database of about 2,000 scientists who are making themselves available to be consultants for free, because they want, not just for Adventure School Bus, for anybody doing anything, because they want the science to be right, right? So you'd call, you know, we'd have, okay, we want to do something on plant communication. We want to do something on Pluto. We want to, whatever. We'd approach the Science Entertainment and Entertainment Exchange with our list of consultants that we needed. And then we'd be given these people that were at NASA or people that were at MIT, you know, amazing scientists, right? And I got to tell you guys that 9 times out of 10, they would say to us, you know, I'm so happy to be working for you with you on this show because I'm a scientist because of the Magic School Bus.
Oh,
result. So it was such confirmation.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Because when you're doing something, you don't know what effect you're having. And here it is,
right, yeah.
Every years later, right? Because it was, oh, there was that much of a gap. Yeah, I'm a scientist because of the Magic School Bus.
That's just
wow!
Isn't that cool?
That's amazing.
Yes, that is cool.
That is cool.
That's great.
Yeah, it was very cool. So it was fun. You know, I just like there wasn't quite the dedication to the way we did scripts that, with Netflix that we had, you know, in the original series. But that's okay. It was nice to reboot it. And Kate McKinnon as Miss Frizzle was.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
And she said when we first, I only met her once or twice when she was doing a voice recording. And the first thing she said to me is, I've always wanted to play Miss Frizzle. Now, you got to love an actress who says that to you instead of, you know, when's lunch or whatever people might say.
Yeah.
And she did such a good job. I loved it. Well, played Miss Frizzle's sister, right? But yeah, it was great.
That's a wonderful show.
That's great.
It really
is. You'll love that show so much. So now, how did the series What's Your News come about?
Oh, yeah. News.
Yes.
What's Your News? News. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Watch that on Sprout a lot.
Yes, me too. I've been watching that a lot on Sprout. Such
that
cool,
was
you know, little series.
A guy I was working with called Chris Dicker. Now, Chris is a designer and he also is a show creator. But we came up with this idea of also he was working with a games company. And so there was this opportunity to use, it was the early days of motion capture. And so the idea of having live animation, right? Or as Henson calls it, digital puppetry. But it's motion capture. And so we thought, let's have a show where the animated characters talk to real kids. And that was what it's a news show for kids where the news is their news. This just in, Jake has just lost a tooth. Reporting live from the scene is, it was all news of scene.
Wow. Well. Three, wow, you're gonna do this to me now? Okay.
Might happen any second.
wait, wait. I was like, my Chris, Jake, and Matt are just have a little problem here. I'll talk to them about it right now or something like that. I mean, so many ideas I could have on my series. Yeah. So many opportunities.
So, yeah, gosh. That was the idea. It was a news show for kids where the news was their news. So just learned to play her first piece on the piano. And it would be real kid news, you know. It was really fun. So that was for Nickelodeon here in the UK. And that was just one of those situations where they,
It's been, of course, sprout here, so.
Yes, it was on the CBC too for a while in Canada. But again, we wanted to do more of it, but again, you know, things didn't get funded, and so that was too bad because I loved that show. And I thought, and it had more potential than they were able to realize because we wanted to have this whole connection with the online thing, so a kid could send in their news. You know, we could report their news and Chiron's underneath. You know, so and so, you know, Sophie from Birmingham has just bought new shoes. They're red. And then the next one, whatever would come up with the kids' news. Yeah.
It's a wonderful show. I gotta watch it again. It's been years.
Me too. It's such a cool little series to put on. You know.
Yeah. So, what went into creating Buddy Patrol?
Buddy Patrol, which never happened, did it?
Really? Oh, was it like a pilot or something?
Yeah, it didn't. That was again Chris Dicker and I, and that was the. I'm forgetting because I loved it. And now I can't remember what it had to do with. It had to do with moral decisions and morality, and right and wrong and all this kind of thing. And I'm sorry to be so vague, but I'm really forgotten what we did, and we tried really hard to get it off the ground, and I don't think it never happened.
Mm.
But that was again Chris Dicker designing and I was working on the scripts.
Nice.
Wow, you guys have done some digging.
Awesome. Oh yeah. So now since we're very close to wrap things up very soon, so can you share any projects you're currently working on? Of course, if you're allowed to talk about.
Well, I am working on. I'd love to because I'm working on my third act heart project, which is called the Watarubas, and it's the Watarubas. There's 81 Watarubas on the planet. They came here 4 billion years ago on the same asteroid, and we meet them first when they meet a young girl called Miriam, an 11-year-old girl. It's a very hard show a very hard project to just sum up. But my log lines for it are Earth from Water's point of view and goofiness in the service of truth. But Miriam, the girl we meet, the human girl we meet, discovers that she has a piece of her grandmother has a piece of this asteroid. They came to the planet 4 billion years ago. She has a piece of the asteroid. In fact, it's the core. And she's about to go to science camp, but she needs something to take to camp. And her grandmother gives her this, take this stone. And she's trying to shove it into, which is in a display case. And she's trying to shove it into her backpack. Then it all hits the floor. Oh, I'm so sorry. She picks it up. She turns into water.
Wow.
Wow.
So the advantage, wow. That's called puddling. But she also unpuddles. And so there's this whole thing with water. Bad guys. I mean, it's what it is. It's turned into, it's going to be television. But then, because that's what I do, right? And it was going to be television. And I had enough independent, private sort of financial help to put together a creative summit. In 2020, in February 2020, and I brought together my nearest and dearest friends, great friends that I worked with on the Magic School Bus, all the people that you could sit around a table and they could tell you something is shit and you don't get upset because they're there to tell you how to make it better. You know, I'm a collaborator. I wanted everybody to rip it up and help me put it back together. And so we came away from that with this idea that I absolutely love. Well, I had the idea, but you know, it was we figured out three series, they were going to be streamed, blah, blah, blah. But then it was the pandemic, and the thought of presenting this heart project that I cared so much about to a screen filled with broadcast executives looking at their phones, I just couldn't do it. So then I thought, okay, I'm going to write it as a book, because I didn't want input from them. I'll write it as a book. It's turned out it's going to be two books, and I finished the first book. The characters are designed. I'm just quick look. The characters. Okay, a Wateruba isn't a creature who lives in water. A Wateruba is water. So if you're looking to have a glass of water, you'd think you're seeing reflections, and then suddenly a creature appears out of the water. And then these are designed by an artist that you may have heard of called Brian Froud, who designed the Dark Crystal. He designed Labyrinth.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
and he's a great friend of mine, and he understood that how these guys had to work. Anyway, so the first book, I've got the text finished. There's gonna be two books. The text for the first getting ready. I'm gonna launch, I hope, in May. Because there's a thing here in Britain called Water Week UK 2024. And I want to launch in conjunction with that, because it's all about kids. It's all about getting things out to kids through the schools, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, that's what I'm, and I said it's for 9 to 12 year olds, this. So there's bad guys in there. And, but it's also, the Wateruba are just goofy, because that's my DNA. Yes, thank you for asking, because that was when
of course
first asked me to do this. I thought, I'm not, it would be nice to make to say, ooh, this is coming. So thank you for allowing me to do that.
Of course.
Yeah, absolutely. And can I wait for those two books to come out? Very looking forward for the release.
Will you have the first one before the second one's published? If I sent you the first one, would be that okay? When yes. No, yeah. I don't have to have both finished, do I?
No.
No.
Second one's on its way.
Nice.
The second one was the work on the set. 3 hours work on the second one was what I thought I'd lost, and when I was trying, going, oh no, there I have, I've got you guys. Anyway, so thank you for asking me. That's great.
Yeah, of course.
For sure.
So this last question.
I hope you got what you wanted.
Pretty much. Yeah. So this last question that Chris is about to ask, we ask all of our guests. Go ahead, Chris.
Thanks, Matt. This podcast is, of course, called Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show. When you think of nostalgia, what do you think of, or how do you define the word nostalgia?
Okay, I think of nostalgia as a sweet heart feeling, as representing a time that made you just feel good. So I know thinking about bad things, that's memories. Nostalgia is good things that make you feel good. So friends that I have, things in childhood in particular, because the nostalgia implies something from before, though now, once you get enough of your life, it can be nostalgia for, when my granddaughter was two, as she turns into being, so just moments. Does that work for you?
Yes, great word to end on.
No, this is really fun, you guys. Thanks so much. I really
Jocelyn, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. This was a blast.
And all the research you did. Impressive.
Yes, and thank you so much for what you've done. Thank you for being on, and thank you so much for what you've done and be a part of our lives. Keep up the great work. What are you doing now? I cannot wait. What's next in store?
Wateruba's. Yes.
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 Yeah. Yes.
Well, keep in touch.
Looking forward to it.
Keep in touch, Jocelyn. And if you want, I'll tell Steve and Kevin that you say hello.
Oh, tell them not just hello. Tell them I've sent lots of love.
Yes.
Wait, both of them.
Yes,
yes,
absolutely. We'll keep in touch, Jocelyn. I will let you know when this goes up.
Okay, thanks. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
A pleasure, Joshua.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Jocelyn. And it's goodbye from us as well. We absolutely enjoyed our time talking to Jocelyn Stevenson. Grew up with a lot of the projects she worked on, so getting to talk to her was lots of fun. Keep on the lookout for more wonderful interviews coming your way. And, you know, again, March 29th, Frag Rock Back to the Rock Season 2.
And her social media and everything in the description down below. Yes. See if anyone want to follow her and check out what she's going to be upcomingly doing with her new book.
Coming out later this year.
Yes.
But yes, for now it's goodbye from Jocelyn, and now it's goodbye from us as well. And as always, what do we say, Jake?
Keep nostalgia alive. Take care, everyone. See you next time. See ya. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to another wonderful Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show interview. Be sure to follow Jake and the crew on social media and stream the show wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And as always, remember to keep nostalgia alive. Bye-bye.